I put a foot carefully onto one of the caravan's shafts and, waving my arms for balance like an aerialist, made my way slowly, heel to toe, up the slope to the driving board. To my surprise, the door had been replaced. I paused to prepare myself, took a deep breath, then opened the door and stepped inside. The blood had been cleaned up, I saw that at once. The floor was newly scrubbed and the sharp, clean smell of sunlight soap still hung in the air. It wasn't dark inside the caravan, but neither was it light. I took a step towards the rear and froze in my tracks. Someone was lying on the bed. Suddenly my heart was pounding in a frenzy, and my eyes felt as if they were about to pop out of their sockets. I hardly dared breathe. In the gloom of the drawn curtains, I could see that it was a woman. No, not a woman. A girl. A few years older than me, perhaps. Her hair was raven black, her complexion tawny, and she was wrapped in a shapeless garment of black crepe. As I stood motionless, staring at her face, her dark eyes opened slowly and met mine. With a quick, powerful spring, she leapt from the bed, snatching something from a shelf, and I suddenly found myself wedged sharply against the wall, my arm twisted behind my back and a knife at my throat. "Let go! You're hurting me!" I managed to squeeze the words out through the pain. "Who are you? What are you doing here?" she hissed. "Tell me before I slit your gullet." I could feel the knife's blade against my windpipe.
"Flavia Toulouse!" I gasped.
Damn it all, I was beginning to cry. I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror, her arm beneath my chin, my bulging eyes, the knife, the knife.
"That's a butter knife," I croaked in desperation.
It was one of those moments that might later seem amusing, but it wasn't now. I was trembling with fear and anger. I felt my head jerk as she pulled back to look at the blade, and then I was being pushed away.
"Get out of here," she said roughly. "Get away now before I take the razor to you."
I didn't need a second invitation. The girl was obviously mad. I stumbled towards the door and jumped to the ground. I grabbed Gladys and was halfway to the trees when...
"Wait,"
her voice echoed in the glade.
"Did you say your name was Flavia? Flavia Deleuze?"
I did not reply, but stopped at the edge of the grove, making sure that I kept Gry between us as a makeshift barrier.
"Please," she said, "wait. I'm sorry. I didn't know who you were. They told me you saved Fenella's life."
"Fenella?" I managed, my voice shaking, still hollowed out by fear.
"Fenella Farr, you brought the doctor to her, here last night."
I must have looked a perfect fool as I stood there with my mouth open like a goldfish. My brain needed time to catch up as the girl flip-flopped suddenly from holding a blade at my throat to being sorry. I was not accustomed to apologies, and this one, probably the first I had ever received in my life, caught me off guard.
"Who are you?"
I asked. "Porcelain," she said, jumping down from the caravan. "Porcelain Lee, Fenella's my gram." She was coming towards me through the grass, her arms extended in biblical forgiveness.
"Let me hug you," she said. "I need to thank you."
I'm afraid I shrank back a little.
"Don't worry, I won't bite," she said,
and suddenly she was upon me, her arms enfolding me in a tight embrace, her chin resting sharply on my shoulder.
"Thank you, Flavia Deleuze," she whispered in my ear, as if we had been friends forever. "Thank you."
Since I was still half expecting a dagger to be plunged between my shoulder blades, I'm afraid I did not return her hug, which I received in stiff silence, rather like one of the sentries at Buckingham Palace, pretending he doesn't notice the liberties being taken by an excessively affectionate tourist.
"You're welcome," I managed. "How is she? Fenella, I mean."
Using the gypsy's first name did not come easily to me. In spite of the fact that Daffy and I have always referred to our own mother as Harriet, only Feely, who is older, seems to have the right to call her Mummy,
It still felt excessively saucy to call a stranger's grandmother by her given name. She'll be all right, they think, too early to tell, but if it hadn't been for you... Tears were beginning to well up in her dark eyes.
It was nothing, I said uncomfortably. She needed help. I was there.
Was it really that simple, or did something deeper lie beneath?
How did you hear about this? I asked, waving at the glade.
The coppers tracked me down in London, found my name and all that on a scrap of paper in a handbag. I begged a ride off a bloke with a lorry in Covent Garden, and he brought me as far as Doddingsley. I walked the rest of the way. Got here no more than an hour ago.
Four gold stars to Inspector Hewitt and his men, I thought. Searching the caravan for Fenella Farr's handbag had never crossed my mind.
Where are you staying? At the 13 Drakes?
Blimey, she said in a feigned Cockney accent. That's a laugh, that is.
I must have looked offended.
I couldn't rub two shillings together if my life depended on it, she said, waving her hands expansively at the grove. So I expect right here is where I'll stay.
Here? In the caravan?
I looked at her aghast. Why not? It's Fenella's, isn't it? That means it's as good as mine. All I have to do is find out who's the knob that owns this bit of green and...
It's called the Parlings, I said, and it belongs to my father.
Actually, it didn't. It belonged to Harriet, but I didn't feel that I needed to explain our family's legal difficulties to a semi-ragamuffin stranger who had just threatened my life.
Cool, she said. I'm sorry. I never thought.
But you can't stay here, I went on. It's a crime scene. Didn't you see the sign?
Course I did. Didn't you? I chose to ignore this childish response.
Whoever attacked your gram might still be hanging about. Until the police find out who and why, it isn't safe to be here after dark.
This was a part, but not all, of the truth. Every bit as important as Porcelain's physical safety was the sudden gnawing need I felt to make amends to the family of Fenella Farr, to correct an old wrong committed by my father. For the first time in my life, I found myself seized by hereditary guilt.
So you'll have to stay at Buckshaw, I blurted.
There, I'd done it. I'd made the leap. But even as I spoke, I knew that I would soon regret my words. Father, for instance, would be furious. Even when his beloved Harriet had invited the gypsies to stay at Buckshaw, Father had driven them off. If she had failed, I didn't stand a chance. Perhaps that was why I did it.
My father's quite eccentric, I said. At least, he has some odd ideas. He won't allow guests at Buckshaw other than his own sister. I'll have to sneak you in.
Porcelain seemed quite alarmed at the thought.
I don't want to make trouble.
Nonsense, I said, sounding like Aunt Felicity, the human steamroller.
It will be no trouble at all. Nobody ever comes into the East Wing. They won't even know you're there.
Bring your things, I ordered.
Until that moment, I hadn't noticed how haggard Porcelain was looking. With her black crepe dress and the black circles under her eyes, she looked like someone made up for a masquerade party. The Grim Reaper as a young woman.
I've nothing, she said. Just what you see.
She tugged apologetically at her heavy hem. This is Fenella's, she said. I had to wash out my own things in the river this morning, and they aren't dry.
Wash out her things? Why would she need to do that?
Since it didn't seem to be any of my business, I didn't ask. Perhaps I could find an excuse to bring it up later.
Off we go, then, I said, trying to sound cheerful. Buckshaw awaits.
I picked up Gladys and wheeled her along beside me. Porcelain trudged a few steps behind, her eyes downcast.
It isn't awfully far, I said after a while. I expect you'll be happy to get some sleep.
I turned and saw her nodding in response, but she did not speak. She shuffled along behind me,
drained, and not even the ornamental dolphins of the Poseidon fountain made her take her eyes from the ground.
"These were made in the 18th century," I told her, "so they're rather elderly. They used to spout water from their mouths."
Again a nod. We were taking a shortcut across the Trafalgar Lawn, an abandoned series of terraces that lay to the southeast of the house. Sir George de Luce, who planned it as a tribute to Admiral Nelson and his victory over the Spanish, which had taken place some 40 years earlier, had laid it out at about the same time as the Visto. By the simple expedient of tapping into Lucius Leaking de Luce's earlier and extensive subterranean waterworks, Sir George had planned to activate his glorious fountain landscape as a surprise for his bride. And so he had begun on a work of landscape architecture that would rival or even surpass the spectacle of the ornamental lake. But speculation during the railway mania had scotched his fortunes. With most of his capital gone, what had been planned as a noble avenue of fountains, with Buckshaw as its focal point, had been abandoned to the elements. Now, after a century of rain and snow, sun and wind, and the nocturnal visits of the villagers who came at night to steal stone for their garden walls, the Trafalgar Lawn and its statues were like a sculptor's scrapyard, with various bits of stone cherubs, mossy tritons, and sea nymphs jutting up out of the ground here and there like stone swimmers from a shipwreck waiting to be rescued from a sea of earth. Only Poseidon had survived, lounging with his net atop a crumbling base, brooding in marble over his broken family, his three-pronged trident like a lightning rod, sticking up towards whatever might be left of the ancient Greek heavens. "Here's old Poseidon," I said, turning to haul Gladys up yet another set of crumbled steps. "His photograph was in Country Life a couple of years ago. Rather splendid, isn't he?" Porcelain had come suddenly to a dead stop, her hand covering her mouth, her hollowed-out eyes staring upwards as wide and as dark as the pit. Then she let out a cry like a small animal. I followed her gaze and saw at once the thing that had frozen her in her tracks. Dangling from Poseidon's trident like a scarecrow hung on a coat hook was a dark figure. "It's Brooky Harewood," I said, even before I saw his face. Chapter 9. One of the trident's tines had pierced Brookie's long moleskin coat at the neck, and he swung slightly in the breeze, looking rather casual in his flat cap and scarlet scarf, as if he were enjoying one of the roundabouts at an amusement pier. For a moment, I thought he might have fallen. Perhaps in an excess of alcoholic high spirits, he'd been attempting to scale the statue. Perhaps he had slipped from Poseidon's head and fallen onto the trident. That idea was short-lived, however. I saw almost at once that his hands were tied behind his back, but that wasn't the worst of it. As I came round full front on, the sun glinted brightly on something that seemed to be projecting from Brookie's mouth. "Stay here," I told Porcelain, even though I could see that there wasn't a chance of her moving. I leaned Gladys against the lower of the three seashell bowls that comprised the fountain, then climbed up her tubular frame until finally I was standing on her seat, from which point I could get a knee up onto the rough stone rim. The bowl of the thing was filled with a disgusting broth of black water, dead leaves and mould, the result of a century of neglect, and it smelled to high heaven. By standing on the rim, I was able to clamber up onto the fountain's middle bowl, and finally the highest one. I was now level with Brookie's knees, staring up into his unseeing eyes. His face was a horrid fish-belly white. He was quite dead, of course. After the initial shock of realizing that someone I had spoken to just hours before was no longer in the land of the living, I began to feel oddly excited. I have no fear of the dead. Indeed, in my own limited experience, I have found them to produce in me a feeling that is quite the opposite of fear. A dead body is much more fascinating than a live one, and I have learned that most corpses tell better stories. I'd had the good fortune of seeing several of them in my time. In fact, Brookie was my third. As I teetered on the edge of the sculptured stone seashell, I could see clearly what it was that had glinted in the sun. Projecting from one of Brookie's nostrils, not his mouth, was an object that first appeared to be a round silver medallion, a flat, perforated disc with a handle attached. On the end of it was suspended a single drop of Brookie's blood. The image punched out of the disc was that of a lobster, and engraved on the handle was the Deluse monogram, D.L. It was a silver lobster pick, one of the set that belonged to Buckshaw. The last time I'd seen one of these sharp-pointed utensils, Dogger had been rubbing it with silver polish at the kitchen table. The business end of the thing, I recalled, ended in two little tines that stuck out like the horns on a snail's head. These prongs, which had been designed to pry the pink meat from the cracks and crevices of a boiled lobster, were now lodged firmly somewhere deep in Brookie Harewood's brain. Death by family silver, I thought, before I could turn off that part of my mind. A little moan from below reminded me that Porcelain was still there. Her face was nearly as white as Brookie's, and I saw that she was trembling. "For God's sake, Flavia," she said in a quavering voice. "Come down. Let's get out of here. I think I'm going to throw up." "It's Brookie Harewood," I said, and I think I offered up a silent prayer for the repose of the poacher's soul. "Protect him, O Lord, and let heaven be bountifully supplied with trout streams." The thought of trout reminded me of Colin Prout. I'd almost forgotten the boy. Would Colin breathe a sigh of relief when he heard that his tormentor was dead? Or would he grieve? Brookie's mother would be in the same quandary. And so, I realized, would almost everyone in Bishop's Lacey. I put one foot on Poseidon's knee and hauled myself up by his muscular elbow. I was now slightly above Brookie and looking down at something that had caught my eye. In the notch between two of the trident's prongs was a shiny spot the size of a sixpence, as if someone had given the bronze a bit of a polish with a rag. I memorized the shape of the thing, then began to climb down slowly, taking great care not to touch Brookie's body. "Come on," I said to Porcelain, giving her arm a shake. "Let's get out of here before they think one of us did it." I did not tell her that the back of Brookie's skull was a bloody mess. We paused for a moment behind one of the rose hedges which, at this time of year, were in their second bloom. From the direction of the kitchen garden came the sound of Dogger scraping old soil from flower pots with a trowel. Mrs. Mallet, I knew, had probably gone for the day. "Stay here," I whispered, "while I scout things out." Porcelain seemed barely to have heard me. White with fright and fatigue, she stood stock still among the roses, like one of Buckshaw's statues, over which someone, as a joke, had flung an old black dress. I flitted, invisibly I hoped, across the grass and the gravelled drive to the kitchen door, flattening myself against it. I pressed my ear to the heavy wood. As I've said, I had inherited from Harriet an almost freakish sense of hearing. Any clatter of pots and pans or the hum of conversation would be instantly audible. Mrs. Mallet talked constantly to herself as she worked, and even though I guessed she had gone for the day, one could never be too careful. If Feely and Daffy were planning another ambush, surely their giggles and their tittering would give them away. But I could hear nothing. I opened the door and stepped into an empty kitchen. My first priority was to get Porcelain into the house and stick her safely away in a place where her presence would be unsuspected. That done, I would call the police. The telephone at Buckshaw was kept out of sight in a small cupboard in the narrow passageway that connected the foyer with the kitchen. As I have said, Father loathed the instrument, and all of us at Buckshaw were forbidden to use the thing. As I tiptoed along the passage, I heard the unmistakable sound of shoe leather on tiles. It was Father, most likely. Daffy and Feely shoes were more feminine and made a softer, more shuffling sound. I ducked into the telephone cubicle and quietly pulled the door shut. I would sit on the little oriental bench in the darkness and wait it out. In the foyer, the footsteps slowed and stopped. I held my breath. After what seemed like 2.5 eternities, they moved away, towards the west wing and Father's study, I thought. At that instant, right at my elbow, the telephone rang, then rang again. A few moments later, the footsteps returned, advancing towards the foyer. I picked up the receiver and pressed it tightly against my chest. If the ringing stopped suddenly, Father would think that the caller had rung off.
"Hello? Hello?"
I could hear a tinny voice saying to my breastbone.
"Are you there?"
Outside, in the foyer, the footsteps stopped and then retreated.
"Are you there? Hello? Hello?"
the muffled voice was now shouting, rather irately. I put the receiver to my ear and whispered into the mouthpiece.
"Hello? Flavia Deleuze speaking."
"Constable Linnet here at Bishop's Lacey. Inspector Hewitt has been attempting to get in touch with you."
"Oh, Constable Linnet,"
I breathed in my best Olivia de Havilland voice.
"I was just about to ring you. I'm so glad you called. The most awful thing has just happened at Buckshaw."
That chore done, I beat a rapid retreat to the rose bushes.
"Come on,"
I said to Porcelain, who was standing precisely as I had left her.
"There's no time to waste."
In less than a minute, we were creeping stealthily up the wide staircase of Buckshaw's East Wing.
"Blimey," Porcelain said when she saw my bedroom. "It's like a blooming parade square."
"And every bit as cold," I replied.
"Climb under the quilt. I'll go fix a hot water bottle."
A quick trip next door to my laboratory, 5 minutes with a Bunsen burner, and I had filled a red rubber bag with boiling water, ready to shove in under Porcelain's feet. I hoisted a corner of my mattress and pulled out a box of chocolates I'd nicked from the kitchen doorstep, where Ned, the smitten pot boy, was forever leaving tributes to Feely. Since Miss Snotrag never knew they'd arrived, she could hardly miss them, could she? I reminded myself to tell Ned, the next time I saw him, how much his gift had been appreciated. I just wouldn't tell him by whom.
"Help yourself," I said, ripping the cellophane from the box. "They may not be as fresh as the flowers in May, but at least they're not crawling with maggots."
Ned's budget could only afford chocolates that had been left in the shop window for a quarter century or more. Porcelain stopped with a vanilla cream halfway to her mouth.
"Go ahead," I told her. "I was teasing."
Actually, I wasn't, but there was no point in upsetting the girl. Meaning to close the drapes, I went to the window, where I paused to have a quick look outside. There was no one in sight. Beyond the lawns, I could see one corner of the Visto, and to the south, Poseidon. I'd completely forgotten that I could see the fountain from my bedroom window. Was it possible that... I rubbed my eyes and looked again. Yes, there he was. Brookie Harewood, from the distance, no more than a dark doll hanging from the sea god's trident. I could easily slip back for another look before the police turned up. And if they did arrive while I was at the scene, I'd tell them that I'd been waiting for them, keeping an eye on Brookie, making sure that nothing was touched, and so forth.
"You look exhausted," I said, turning to Porcelain.
Her eyelids were already flickering as I drew the drapes.
"Sleep tight," I said,
but I don't think she heard me. The doorbell rang as I came down the stairs.
Rats! Just when I thought I was alone.
I counted to 10 and opened the door, just as the bell rang again. Inspector Hewitt was standing there, his finger still on the button, a slightly embarrassed look on his face as if he were a small boy who'd been caught playing Knock Knock Run.
They certainly don't believe in letting the grass grow under their feet, I thought.
It had been less than 10 minutes since I'd spoken to Constable Linnet.
The inspector seemed a little taken aback to see me at the door.
Ah, he said, the ubiquitous Flavia Deluce.
Good afternoon, Inspector, I said, in a butter wouldn't melt in her heart voice. Won't you come in?
Thank you, no, he replied. I understand there's been another incident.
An incident, I said, falling into the game. It's Brookie Harewood, I'm afraid. The quickest way to the Trafalgar lawn is through here, I added, pointing towards the east. Follow me and I'll show you.
Hold on, Inspector Hewitt said. You'll do no such thing. I want you to keep completely out of this. Do you understand, Flavia?
It is our property, Inspector, I said, just to remind him that he was talking to a Deluce.
Yes, and it's my investigation. So much as one of your fingerprints at the scene, and I'll have you up on charges. Do you understand?
What insolence! It didn't deserve an answer. I could have said, my fingerprints are already at the scene, Inspector.
But I didn't. I spun on my heel and slammed the door in his face.
Inside, I quickly clapped my ear to the panel and listened for all I was worth. Although it sounded like a dry chuckle, the sound I heard must really have been a little cry of dismay from the inspector at having so foolishly lost the services of a first-rate mind. Damn and bless the man! He'd regret his high-handed manner. Oh, yes, he would. He'd regret it. Up the stairs I flew to my chemical laboratory. I unlocked the heavy door, stepped into the room, and almost instantly relaxed as a deep feeling of peace came over me. There was something special about the place, the way in which the light fell so softly through the tall, leaded casement windows, the warm brass glow of the lights microscope that had once belonged to Uncle Tar and was now so satisfyingly mine, the crisp, almost eager shine of the laboratory's glassware, the cabinets filled with neatly labelled bottles of chemicals, including some quite remarkable poisons, and the rows upon rows of books. All of these lent to the room something I can only describe as a sense of sanctuary. I took one of the tall laboratory stools and lifted it onto a counter near the windows. Then, from the bottom drawer of the desk, which, because it contained his diaries and documents, I still thought of as being Uncle Tar's, I removed a pair of German binoculars. Their lenses, I had learned from one of the books in his library, had been made from a special sand found only in the Thuringian forest near the village of Martinsroda in Germany, which, because of its aluminium oxide content, produced an image of remarkable clarity, which was precisely what I needed. With the binoculars hung round my neck, I used a chair to climb up onto the countertop, then scaled the stool, where I teetered uneasily atop my improvised observation tower, my head almost touching the ceiling. Using one hand to steady myself against the window frame and the binoculars pressed to my eyes with the other, I used whatever fingers were left to turn the focusing knob. As the hedges surrounding the Trafalgar lawn sprang into sharp detail, I realized that the view from the laboratory, and from this angle, should be much better than the one I'd had from my bedroom window. Yes, there was Poseidon, gazing out upon his invisible ocean, oblivious to the dark bundle dangling from his trident. But now I had a good view of the entire fountain. With distance collapsed by the powerful lenses, I could also see Inspector Hewitt as he came into view from behind the fountain, raised a hand to shield his eyes from the sun, and stood gazing up at Brookie's body. He pursed his lips, and I could almost hear in my mind the little whistle that escaped him. I wondered if he knew he was being watched. The image in the binoculars faded suddenly, was restored, and then faded again. I took the glasses away from my eyes and realized that a sudden cloud had blotted out the sun. Although it was too far to the west for me to actually see it, I could tell by the darkness that had fallen on the landscape that we were in for a storm. I raised the binoculars again just in time to see that the inspector was now looking directly at me. I gasped, then realized that it was a trick of the optics. Of course he couldn't see me. He must be looking up at the storm clouds that were gathering over Buckshaw. He turned away, then turned again, and now it appeared as if he was talking to somebody. And so he was. As I looked on, Detective Sergeant Woolmer came round the base of the fountain carrying a heavy kit, closely followed by Dr. Darby and Detective Sergeant Graves.
They must all have come in the same car, I thought, and driven round by way of the gully and the palings.
Before you could say Jack Robinson, Sergeant Woolmer had set up his folding tripod and attached the heavy police camera. I marvelled at how deftly his stubby fingers handled the delicate controls and how quickly he managed to take his initial exposures. There was a sudden blinding flash of lightning, followed almost instantly by an ear-splitting clap of thunder, and I nearly toppled off the stool. I let the binoculars fall free to dangle round my neck and slapped both hands against the window panes to regain my balance.
What was it Daffy had once told me during a summer downpour? Stay away from windows during a thunderstorm, you silly moke.
Now here I was, with lightning licking at the transom, pinned against the glass like a butterfly to a card in the Natural History Museum.
Even if the lightning misses you, she'd added, the breath will be sucked from your lungs by the sound of the thunder, and you'll be turned inside out like a red sock.
The lightning flashed again, and the thunder roared, and now the rain was coming down in sweeping sheets, pounding on the roof like the roll of kettle drums. A sudden wind had sprung up, and the trees in the park pitched wildly in its gusts. Actually, it was quite exhilarating.
Daffy be damned, I thought. If I practiced a bit, I could even come to love the thunder and the lightning.
I straightened up, adjusted my balance, and raised the glasses to my eyes. What I saw was like a scene from hell. In the watery green light, blown by the wind and illuminated by erratic flashes of lightning, the three policemen were removing Brookie's body from the trident. They had looped a rope under his armpits and were lowering him slowly, almost tenderly, to the ground. Towering above them in the rain, Poseidon, like a monstrous stone Satan with his pitchfork at the ready, still stared out across his watery world as if he were bored stiff with the antics of mere humans. Inspector Hewitt reached out to touch the rope and ease the body's descent, his hair plastered flat against his forehead by the rain, and for a moment I had the feeling that I was watching some horrific passion play. And perhaps I was. Only when Sergeant Woolmer had fetched a bit of tarpaulin from his kit and covered Brookie's body did the men seem to think of sheltering themselves. Although it provided precious little protection, Dr. Darby held his black medical bag above his head and stood there motionless, looking miserable in the rain. Inspector Hewitt had unfolded a small transparent raincoat and slipped it on over his saturated clothing. It seemed like something that a chambermaid might wear, and I wondered if his lovely wife, Antigone, had slipped it into his pocket for emergencies such as this. Sergeant Woolmer stood stolid in the downpour, as if his bulk were protection enough against the wind and rain, while Sergeant Graves, who was the only one of the four small enough to do so, had tucked himself comfortably under the lowest bowl of the fountain on the downwind side, where he squatted as dry as a duck. Then suddenly, as quickly as it had begun, the storm was over. The dark cloud was now drifting off to the east as the sun reappeared and the birds renewed their interrupted songs. Sergeant Woolmer removed the waterproof covering with which he had draped his camera and began photographing the fountain from every imaginable angle. As he began his close-ups, an ambulance came into view, teetering its way across the rough ground between the palings and the Trafalgar lawn. After a few words with the driver, Dr. Darby helped shift Brookie's shrouded body onto a stretcher, then climbed into the passenger's seat. As the ambulance bumped slowly away, swerving to avoid the half-buried statuary, I noticed that a rainbow had appeared. An eerie yellow light had come upon the landscape, making it seem like some garish painting by a madman. On the far side of the Trafalgar lawn, at the edge of the trees, something moved. I swiveled a bit and refocused quickly, just in time to see a figure vanish into the wood. Another poacher, I thought, watching the police, not wanting to be seen. I made a slow sweep of the tree trunks, but whoever had been there was gone. I found the ambulance again with the binoculars and watched until it vanished behind a distant hedge. When it was lost to view, I climbed down from the stool and locked up the laboratory. If I wanted to search Brookie's digs before the police got there, I'd have to get cracking. Chapter 10. The only problem was this. I hadn't the faintest idea where Brookie lived. I could have made another visit to the telephone closet, I suppose, but in Buckshaw's foyer I was risking an encounter with Father, or worse, with Daffy or Feely. Besides, it seemed most unlikely that an ne'er-do-well such as Brookie would be listed in the directory. Rather than risk being caught, I slipped stealthily into the picture gallery, which occupied nearly the entire ground floor of the East Wing. An army of Deleuze ancestors gazed down upon me as I passed, in whose faces I recognized, uncomfortably, aspects of my own. I wouldn't have liked most of them, I thought, and most of them wouldn't have liked me. I did a cartwheel just to show them that I didn't care. Still, because the old boy deserved it, I gave Uncle Tar's portrait a brisk girl guide salute, even though I'd been drummed out of that organization, quite unfairly, I thought, by a woman with no sense of humor whatsoever. "Honestly, Miss Pashley," I'd have told her, had I been given half a chance, "the ferric hydroxide was only meant to be a joke." At the far end of the gallery was a box room which, in Buckshaw's glory days, had been used for the framing and repair of the portraits and landscapes that made up my family's art collection. A couple of deal shelves and the workbench in the room were still littered with dusty tins of paint and varnish, whose contents had dried out at about the same time as Queen Victoria, and from which brush handles stuck up here and there like fossilized rat's tails. Everyone but me seemed to have forgotten that this room had a most useful feature, a sashed window that could be raised easily from both inside and out, and all the more so since I had taken to lubricating its slides with lard pinched from the pantry. On the outside wall, directly below the window casing, and halfway to the ground, a brick had half crumbled away. Its slow decay encouraged somewhat, I'll admit, by my hacking at it with one of Dogger's trowels. A perfect foothold for anyone who wished to leave or get back into the house without attracting undue attention. As I scrambled out the window and climbed to the ground, I almost stepped on Dogger, who was on his knees in the wet grass. He got to his feet, lifted his hat, and replaced it.
"Good afternoon, Miss Flavia."
"Good afternoon, Dogger."
"Lovely rain."
"Quite lovely." Dogger glanced up at the golden sky, then went on with his weeding. "The very best people are like that. They don't entangle you like flypaper." Gladys's tires hummed happily as we shot past St. Tancred's and into the High Street. She was enjoying the day as much as I was. Ahead on my left, a few doors from the 13 Drakes, was Reggie Pettibone's antique shop. I was making a mental note to pay it a visit later when the door flew open and a spectacled boy came hurtling into the street. It was Colin Prout. I swerved to avoid hitting him, and Gladys went into a long, shuddering slide. "Colin," I shouted as I came to a stop. I had very nearly taken a bad tumble. But Colin had already crossed the High Street and vanished into Bolt Alley, a narrow, reeking passage that led to a lane behind the shops. Needless to say, I followed, offering up fresh praise for the invention of the Sturmey Archer three-speed shifter.
Into the lane I sped, but Colin was already disappearing round the corner at the far end. A few seconds more, having taken a roughly circular route, and he would be back in the high street. I was right. By the time I caught sight of him again, he was cutting into Cow Lane as if the hounds of hell were at his heels. Rather than following, I applied the brakes. Where Cow Lane ended at the river, I knew, Colin would veer to the left and follow the old towpath that ran behind the 13 Drakes. He would not risk going to ground anywhere along the old canal for fear of being boxed in behind the shops. I turned completely round and went back the way I'd come, making a broad, sweeping turn into Shoe Street, where Miss Pickery, the new librarian, lived in the last cottage. I braked, dismounted, and, leaning Gladys against her fence, climbed quickly over the stile and crept into position behind one of the tall poplars that lined the towpath. Just in time, here was Colin hurrying towards me and all the while looking nervously back over his shoulder. "Hello, Colin," I said, stepping directly into his path. Colin stopped as if he had walked into a brick wall, but the shifting of his pale eyes, magnified like oysters by his thick lenses, signalled that he was about to make a break for it. "The police are looking for you, you know. Do you want me to tell them where you are?" It was a bald-faced lie, one of my specialties.
No.
His face had gone as white as tissue paper, and I thought for a moment he was going to blubber. But before I could tighten the screws, he blurted out,
"I never done it, Flavia, honest. Whatever they think I done, I didn't."
In spite of his tangle of words, I knew what he meant.
"Didn't do what, Colin? What is it you haven't done?"
"Nothing. I haven't done nothing."
"Where's Brookie?" I asked casually. "I need to see him about a pair of fire irons."
My words had the desired effect. Colin's arms swung round like the vanes on a weathercock, his fingers pointing north, south, west, east. He finally settled on the latter, indicating that Brookie was to be found somewhere beyond the 13 Drakes.
"Last time I seen him, he was unloading his van."
His van? Could Brookie have a van? Somehow the idea seemed ludicrous, as if the Scarecrow from the Wizard of Oz had been spotted behind the wheel of a Bedford lorry.
And yet...
"Thanks awfully, Colin," I told him.
"You're a wonder."
With a scrub at his eyes and a tug at his hair, he was over the stile and up Shoe Street like a whirling dervish. And then he was gone.
Had I just made a colossal mistake?
Perhaps I had, but I could hardly carry out my inquiries with someone like Colin drooling over my shoulder. Only then did a cold horror of an idea come slithering across my mind. What if... But no, if there'd been blood on Colin's clothing, I'd surely have noticed it. As I walked back to retrieve Gladys, I was taken with a rattling good idea. In all of Bishop's Lacey, there were very few vans, most of which were known to me on sight. The ironmongers, the butchers, the electricians, and so forth. Each one had the name of its owner in prominent letters on the side panels. Each was unique and unmistakable. A quick ride up the high street would account for most of them, and a strange van would stand out like a sore thumb. And so it did. A few minutes later, I had pedalled a zigzag path throughout the village without any luck, but as I swept round the bend at the east end of the high street, I could hardly believe my eyes. Parked in front of Willow Villa was a disreputable green van that, although its rusty panels were blank, had Brookie Harewood written all over it. Willow Villa was aptly named for the fact that it was completely hidden beneath the drooping tassels of a giant tree, which was just as well, since the house was painted a hideous shade of orange. It belonged to Tilda Mountjoy, whom I had met under rather unhappy circumstances a few months earlier. Miss Mountjoy was the retired librarian-in-chief of the Bishop's Lacey Free Library, where, it was said,
Even the books had lived in fear of her. Now, with nothing but time on her hands, she had become a freelance holy terror. Although I was not anxious to renew our acquaintance, there was nothing for it but to open her gate, push my way through the net of dangling fronds, squelch through the mosses underfoot, and beard the dragon in her den. My excuse? I would tell her that, while out bicycling, I had been overcome with a sudden faintness. Seeing Brookie's van, I thought that perhaps he would be kind enough to load Gladys into the rear and drive me home. Father, I was sure, would be filled with eternal gratitude, etc., etc., etc. Under the willow's branches, lichens flourished on the doorstep, and the air was as cool and dank as a mausoleum. I had already raised the corroded brass knocker, which was in the shape of the Lincoln Imp, when the door flew open, and there stood Miss Mountjoy, covered with blood. I don't know which of us was the most startled to see the other, but for a peculiar moment we both of us stood perfectly still, staring wide-eyed at each other. The front of her dress and the sleeves of her grey cardigan were soaked with the stuff, and her face was an open wound. A few fresh drops of scarlet had already plopped to the floor before she lifted a bloody handkerchief and clapped it to her face.
"Nosebleed," she said. "I get them all the time."
With her mouth and nose muffled by the stained linen, it sounded as if she had said, "I give them all the twine." But I knew what she meant.
"Gosh, Miss Mountjoy," I blurted, "let me help you."
I seized her arm and, before she could protest, steered her towards the kitchen through a dark hallway lined with heavy Tudor sideboards.
"Sit down," I said, pulling out a chair. And to my surprise, she did.
My experience with nosebleeds was limited, but practical. I remembered one of Feely's birthday parties at which Sheila Foster's nose had erupted on the croquet lawn and Dogger had stanched it with someone's handkerchief, dipped in a solution of copper sulfate from the greenhouse. Willow Villa, however, didn't seem likely to have a supply of blue vitriol, as the solution was called, although I knew that, given no more than half a teacup of dilute sulfuric acid, a couple of pennies, and the battery from Gladys's bicycle lamp, I could whip up enough of the stuff to do the trick. But this was no time for chemistry. I grabbed for an ornamental iron key that hung from a nail near the fireplace and clapped it to the back of her neck. She let out a shriek and came halfway out of the chair. "Easy now," I said, as if talking to a horse. A quick vision of clinging to Gry's mane in the darkness came to mind. "Easy." Miss Mountjoy sat rigid, her shoulders hunched. Now was the time.
"Is Brookie here?" I said conversationally. "I saw his van outside."
Miss Mountjoy's head snapped back, and I felt her stiffen even more under my hand. She slowly removed the bloody handkerchief from her nose and said with perfect cold clarity,
"Harewood will never set foot in this house again."
I blinked. Was Miss Mountjoy merely stating her determination, or was there something more ominous in her words?
Did she know that Brookie was dead?
As she twisted round to glare at me, I saw that her nosebleed had stopped. I let the silence lengthen, a useful trick I had picked up from Inspector Hewitt.
"The man's a thief," she said at last. "I should never have trusted him. I don't know what I was thinking."
"Can I bring you anything, Miss Mountjoy? A glass of water? A damp cloth?"
It was time to ingratiate myself. Without a word, I went to the sink and wetted a hand towel. I wrung it out and gave it to her. As she wiped the blood from her face and hands, I looked away discreetly, taking the opportunity to examine the kitchen. It was a square room with a low ceiling. A small green agar crouched in the corner, and there was a plain, scrubbed deal table with a single chair, the one in which Miss Mountjoy was presently sitting. A plate rail ran round two sides of the room, upon which were displayed an assortment of blue and white plates and platters, mostly Staffordshire, by the look of them,
village greens and country scenes for the most part. I counted 11, with an empty space about a foot and a half in diameter where a 12th plate must once have hung. Filtered through the willow branches outside, the wheat green lights that seeped in through the two small windows above the sink gave the plates a weird and watery tint, which reminded me of what the Trafalgar lawn had looked like after the rain, after the taking down of Brookie's body from the Poseidon fountain. At the entrance to the narrow passage through which we had entered the kitchen was a chipped wooden cabinet, on top of which was a cluster of identical bottles, all of them medicinal-looking. Only as I read their labels did the smell hit me.
How odd, I thought.
The sense of smell is usually lightning fast, often speedier than that of sight or hearing. But now there was no doubt about it. The whole room, even Miss Mountjoy herself, reeked of cod liver oil. Perhaps until that moment, the sight of Miss Mountjoy's nosebleed and her blood-splattered clothing had overwhelmed my sense of smell. Although I had first noticed a fishy odour when I saw her dripping blood at the door, and again when I had applied the cold key to the nape of her neck, my brain must have labelled the fact as not immediately important and tucked it away for later consideration. My experience of cod liver oil was vast. Much of my life had been spent fleeing the oncoming Mrs. Mullet, who, with uncorked bottle and a spoon the size of a garden spade, pursued me up and down the corridors and staircases of Buckshaw, even in my dreams. Who in their right mind would want to swallow something that looked like discarded engine oil and was squeezed out of fish livers that had been left to rot in the sun? The stuff was used in the tanning of leather, and I couldn't help wondering what it would do to one's insides. "Open up, dearie," I could hear Mrs. Mullet calling as she trundled after me. "It's good for you." "No, no," I would shriek. "No, acid. Please don't make me drink acid." And it was true. I wasn't just making this up. I had analysed the stuff in my laboratory and found it to contain a catalogue of acids, among them oleic, margaric, acetic, butyric, phthalic, cholic, and phosphoric, to say nothing of the oxides, calcium and sodium. In the end, I had made a bargain with Mrs. M. She would allow me to take the cod liver oil alone in my room at bedtime, and I would stop screaming like a tortured banshee and kicking at her ankles. I swore it on my mother's grave. Harriet, of course, had no grave. Her body was somewhere in the snows of Tibet. Happy to be relieved of a difficult and unwanted task, Mrs. Mullet had pretended to be scandalized, but cheerfully handed over both spoon and bottle. My mind came snapping back to the present like a rubber ball on an elastic string. "Trouble with antiques, was it?" I heard myself say. "You're not alone in that, Miss Mountjoy." Although I almost missed it, her rapid glance upwards, towards the spot where the missing plate had hung, told me I had hit the bullseye. She saw me following her gaze. "It was from the time of Hong Wu, the first Ming Emperor. He told me he knew a man." "Brookie?" I interrupted. She nodded. "He said he knew someone who could have the piece assessed discreetly and at reasonable cost. Things have been difficult since the war, you see, and I thought of—" "Yes, I know, Miss Mountjoy," I said. "I understand." With Father's financial difficulties and the blizzard of past due accounts that arrived with every postal delivery being the subject of much idle chit-chat in Bishop's Lacey, there was no need for her to explain her own poverty. Her look formed a bond between us. Partners in debt, it seemed to say.
"He told me the railway had broken it. He'd packed the plate in straw, he said, and put it in a barrel. But somehow he'd taken out no insurance, of course, trying to keep expenses down, trying not to burden me with additional—" "And then?"
"Someone spotted it in an antique shop," I blurted.
She nodded. "My niece, Julia, in Pimlico. She said, Auntie, you'll never guess what I saw today. The mate to your Ming. She was standing right there where you are, and just as you did, she looked up and saw the empty space on the shelf. Oh, Auntie, she said. Oh, Auntie. We tried to get the plate back, of course, but the man said he had it on consignment from an MP who lived in the next street. Couldn't give out names because of confidentiality. Julia was all for going to the police, but I reminded her that Uncle Jameson, who brought the piece into the family, was not always on the up and up. I'm sorry to have to tell you that story, Flavia, but I've always made it a point to be scrupulously honest. I nodded and gave her a little look of disappointment. "But Brookie Harewood," I said, "how did he come to get his hands on the plate?"
"Because he's my tenant. He lives in my coach house, you see."
"Brookie? Here? In Miss Mountjoy's coach house? Well, this was news to me."
"Oh, yes," I said, "of course he does. I'd forgotten. Well, then, I'd better be getting along. I think you'd best lie down for a while, Miss Mountjoy. You're still quite pale. A nosebleed takes so much out of one, doesn't it? Iron and so forth. You must be quite worn out."
I led her to the little parlour I had seen at the front of the house and helped her recline on a horsehair settee. I covered her with an afghan and left her clutching at it with white fingers.
"I'll see myself out," I said.
Chapter 11. Like an actor in the pantomime muddling his way out from behind the curtains, I pushed aside the hanging willow branches and stepped out from the green gloom and into the blinding glare of the sun's spotlight.
Time was running out. Inspector Hewitt and his men were probably minutes away, and my work was hardly begun. Since Brookie's van was directly in front of me, I'd begin there. I glanced quickly up and down the street. There was no one in sight. One of the van's windows was rolled all the way down, obviously just as Brookie had left it. Here was a bit of luck. Father was always going on about the importance of carrying a handkerchief at all times, and for once he was right. Opening the door would leave my fingerprints on the nickel-plated handle. A clean bit of linen was just the ticket. But the handle wouldn't budge, although it did give off an alarming groan that hinted of extensive rust beneath. One thing that I didn't need was to have a van door fall off and go clattering into the street. I stepped up onto the running board, another metallic groan, and used my elbows to lever myself into position. With my stomach on the bottom of the window frame, I was able to hinge the top half of my body into the van, leaving my legs and feet sticking straight out in the air for balance. With the handkerchief wrapped round my hand, I pressed on the glove compartment's release button, and when it popped open, reached inside and pulled out a small packet. It was, as I thought it might be, the registration papers for the van. I almost let out a cheer. Now I would find out Brookie's real address, which I somehow doubted would be Willow Villa. Edward Sampson, the document said. Rye Road, East Finching. I knew well enough where East Finching was. It lay about 5 miles by road to the north of Bishop's Lacey.
But who is Edward Sampson?
Other than being the owner of the van from which my bottom was probably projecting like a lobster's claw from a trap, I hadn't the faintest idea. I shoved the papers back into the glove compartment and pushed home the panel. Now for the coach house.
Come along, Gladys, I said,